right, so it is time for another episode of The Fifth Estate. My name is Jay Caruso. I'm here with my co-host, Mr. Neil Doing. How are you, sir?
I'm doing great, Jay. And how are you?
Doing well, doing well. Hey, as we always say at the start of the show, if you like what you hear, please subscribe to the show. Go leave us a rating. We like subscriptions and we like reviews and we like people to rate how well we're doing.
We surely do. We thrive on it. And even the merest bit of your attention is appreciated.
Yeah. So, we're less than 2 weeks away from the election. You believe
yeah,
it?
Yeah, Jay, you know, there's an election going on. I understand it's been fairly contentious so far.
A little bit. I mean, it's been contentious all around. It's made people contentious towards each other. It's not just the candidates. It's people who are out there, the voters, the pundits, people like us, you know, getting upset, getting angry, you know, but we do have one less than 2 weeks. And what way to kind of bring in, you know, we want to talk about, you know, what's going to be next for the GOP, Republicans, conservatism, the whole bit. And what better way to do that with our guest from founder and editor of the Weekly Standard, Mr. Bill Kristol is here. Bill, how are you?
I was better until you mentioned the election. I was hoping we could spend the whole 45, 55 minutes not talking about that. You know, there's a World Series going on. I have some deep thoughts about that. The Cubs, the Indians, strengths and weaknesses. There's a new Jack Reacher novel, a movie out, and I'm a big fan of the novels. We can talk about whether Tom Cruise really is a good Jack Reacher. I'm disappointed that you guys are just defaulting to the most obvious topic, you know, this minor election that's going on out there in the country.
Well, I'll just say right up front, I think Tom Cruise makes an excellent Jack Reacher.
Oh, God, what are you talking about?
Oh, no, here we go.
Is that he's a big guy.
Yeah,
he's huge,
6'8", yeah.
This is what gives us Donald Trump. You know, this kind of lack of judgment, kind of total distortion, worship of celebrities. I'm really disappointed there, you know.
To be fair, I haven't seen the second movie yet, which I understand is not as good as the first. So yeah, maybe I'd change my phrase.
I haven't seen it either. So I like the novels enough that I'm gonna see the movie, even if I disapprove of Tom Cruise, who I think is like my height. Isn't he 5'7" or something?
Yeah, he's not. Yeah, that I never read the book, so I really liked the movie. And when I told people, it was kind of the same reaction. What? How could you possibly like that? It was nothing. He's like 6'8" and 270 pounds, and I'm like, okay, well, you know, I didn't read the book, so I don't know.
Right. No. This is a big problem of people who like books, and then no one who likes any book, not either great novel or mystery novels or anything, likes the movies or TV shows that are made out of them, right? Because you have this kind
very
of
true
image in your own mind, and then it's not what you thought, and it's not a good way to judge.
Right.
Anyway,
well,
so that's happening. But if you insist on talking about the Republican Party, Trump, the election, I guess I'm game.
If you will do us the honor, I think we all had sort of an image in our mind of how this election was going to go, and it hasn't exactly been realized. I think it might be fair to say that the GOP is riven by strife. Would that be an accurate characterization?
Yeah, it sure would be. And I mean, I don't think we were foolish a year and a half ago when most of us thought, A, the 2014 election was objectively very good for the Republicans. B, they were now the majority party in what, the Senate, the House, the governor's mansions, two-thirds, I think, of legislative chambers, close to that, right? And that C, the actual Republicans who'd been elected in 2014 were impressive. They were a lot of them were young, they were diverse, they were intelligent. That was kind of, you felt like, gee, this party which has struggled, which has nominated a lot of fine people who weren't great candidates in the past, the Doles and the McCains and the Romneys, maybe turning the corner and really, you know, seizing the mantle for the future. And then you looked at the presidential field, and it was a little overrated, probably in terms of, oh, it's such a strong bench and all that, but still impressive governors, senators, establishment figures, you know, conservative figures. And then Trump comes along, upsets the apple cart, and you end up with, I really think, the one Republican nominee who's likely to lose to Hillary Clinton, the one Republican nominee who's likely to draw the lowest percentage of young voters, than even the 73-year-old Bob Dole and the, you know, rich Wall Street guy Mitt Romney drew against, in Romney's case, running against Obama, after all. And think about that the Republicans are going to get probably a lower percentage of the youth vote against Hillary Clinton than they got against Barack Obama. So it's been disappointing. And as I say, I don't think we were crazy to think it could have been better. I don't think that was just a mirage back in 2015. I know a fair number, I've met a fair number of these young Republican senators and congressmen, as you guys have, and they are genuinely impressive. It wasn't like a myth that Tom Cotton and Ben Sasse and Joni Ernst and governors like Nikki Haley and Susana Martinez and Scott Walker and others, or Charlie Baker in Massachusetts, were actually impressive young political figures. And so to end up with a 70-year-old, reality TV star with a very checkered business career who turns out to be a populist demagogue with authoritarian tendencies, to say the least, that was kind of one of the major disappointments of my political adult life, really, honestly.
Well, that about wraps it up. I mean, you know.
I suppose we should all think about how it happened and what the implications are. And it's not unimportant. I don't mean to sound like there are important lessons to be drawn, obviously, from something like this. But it is worth reminding ourselves. And this is, in a way, what you said at the beginning, how startling a moment it is, you know.
Right. Well, let's look at the least likely scenario. At this point, the least likely scenario is Trump is going to win. I mean, there's just the data, the numbers out there just don't portend a Trump victory. But let's say by some miracle that he turns it around. I don't think it's going to be a long discussion because I don't think it's really worth our time. But I think we might explore it just for a couple of minutes. Is what if he wins? What does that do to the Republican Party? Or even if he loses, like, let's say he loses a very, very close race. Let's say, like, it's a razor-thin margin, and, you know, Hillary wins, like, 272 electoral votes, and he wins 200, whatever it is, either a win or a very, very narrow loss. Is that going to give, obviously, it will give the kind of this populist movement, this anti-free trade, you know, this, I said today that, it, you know, I hear Trump supporters calling conservatives neocon globalists. I said, which sounds like something you hear from the left. So what's going to happen at that point? What does he do to the Republican Party if that happens?
I mean, I'd say whatever happens, it's hard to predict, honestly, because Trump is a very unusual candidate. I'm not saying that in a pejorative way, just analytically, we haven't had people like Trump run for win major party. We've always had them run for president. We've not had them win major party nominations for the presidency. So what he does, either as a winner or a loser, what his effect is on the party, is a little hard. It's just hard to figure out. And I think we'll just have to see. It could be like Goldwater. Could it be like McGovern? Could it be like other people who've lost and just, you know, went away and nothing much changed? It's just that in the past, we've had these types run and be prominent figures in American politics on right and left. They just haven't. As I say, I don't think you can really think of a comparable major party nominee. So having said that, if he were to win, look, he's president of the United States. We would all have to wish and I think do our best to help him, advise him to do the right thing. And if you're president, he's the only one we have. I assume Republicans would hold the House and the Senate. It would be such an amazing upset to come from behind to win that he would have a huge amount of momentum and legitimacy. I guess the question is, would he try to turn that legitimacy into legitimacy for every policy he's embraced or vaguely talked about? Or would he be open to sort of saying, okay, I'm a Republican president, a Republican Congress, let's do some things that more Republicans agree upon rather than, you know, embracing some alt-right agenda in various aspects of American domestic and foreign policy? And that's just an open question with Trump. We don't have much of a track record there to judge, but that would be pretty. I think it's a mistake to think that if he wins, he wouldn't be powerful. I think it would be such a huge victory. It would be, he would have an awful lot of power, and everyone else would be adjusting to a Trump universe. If he loses a close race, he'd also have a lot of clout and legitimacy. I suppose if it were close enough, Republicans would certainly hold the House and probably hold the Senate, right? And then Trump and Trumpism is a major force in the party. One thing I just don't know, and I don't know what you guys think of this, is how much of Trumpism is about Trump and the celebrity and the straight talk and the showmanship and the willingness to say some outrageous things, and how much of it is about any actual policy issue. I mean, I think immigration probably counts as a real issue that really helped Trump. Trade, I guess people say it did. I'm personally a little more skeptical about that, but the rest of it all, I don't know. Would people have different views of Trump if he were anti-Putin instead of pro-Putin? You know, I kind of doubt it. So I don't quite know what's Trumpism and what's Trump. And I think that's a big question if he loses. I mean, is there a Trumpism to pick off the way there was Goldwaterism. There was a conservative movement. Goldwater got crushed, but the movement was alive. Reagan wins in 66 and becomes governor. McGovern gets crushed, but McGovernism is alive. And a bunch of young McGovernites go on to lead the Democratic Party, basically. Is that the situation we're facing? Or is it more like he loses? It was an expression of anger and anxiety and unhappiness. And some of it gets absorbed and a lot of it kind of goes away and he goes away. I don't know. That's possible, too, I think.
I think there's some merit to the suggestion that what Trump has really tapped into is a lot of anxiety and resentment and anger. And so if it's not necessarily Trump delivering the message, you know, someone else could come along and pick up that same thread and potentially exploit, you know, the same path that Trump did to get the nomination. So I, in answer to your question about whether it's about Trump, I think certainly to a large extent it is about the force of his personality. But I think he's apparently tapping into something that's within people and speaking to their concerns, whether those concerns are legitimate and should be indulged is another question, I guess. But
yeah, I mean, one thing to think about, and this is. Will happen, I mean, empirically, is, okay, there'll be a lot of Republican primaries in 2018. There'll be some in 2017. I live in Virginia. We'll have a governor's race where Ed Gillespie is the putative, the prospective Republican nominee. He ran a very close race for the Senate in 2014, and everyone thinks he'd have a great shot at winning the governorship and back for the Republicans in 2017. But he'll have clearly a Trump-type challenger, maybe more than one. There'll be if Kane becomes vice president, the Clinton-Kane ticket wins, then there'll be a special election for the Senate, I believe, at the same time in Virginia. There'll be a Republican primary there, too, where I imagine there'll be three or four candidates. One can imagine Ken Cuccinelli, who was Cruz chairman in the state and a well-known conservative in the state who lost, what did he lose? I guess he lost the governor's race before Gillespie lost the Senate race by a couple of points to McAuliffe. He could run. There could be a moderate who could run. There could be more of a Trump-type, you know, person who would run. And then, of course, in 2018, there'll be just a whole bunch of primary challenges, I think, including to incumbents and including both ways, incidentally. I could imagine anti-Trumpers challenging Trumpers, Trumpers challenging anti-Trumpers. Of course, the old conservative establishment split hasn't exactly gone away. And so a lot of this will be resolved in the sense that there'll be actual fights at the ballot box. It won't just be, you know, all of us sitting around talking and writing about it. And we'll see where the votes are in the Republican Party. And we'll see which issues take off. I mean, is there a big trade fight? Is there a big foreign policy fight? Is there an immigration fight? Or do those issues turn out to be not so divisive in the Republican Party? And everyone agrees on fighting Hillary Clinton's expansion of government? Or one can imagine the opposite. Someone on the Hill made a good point to me. What if Hillary Clinton does more in Syria than Barack Obama, which is, you know, possible, quite possible, actually, I suspect, and does some stuff that people like John McCain and Lindsey Graham have been calling for and that I would be, for example, inclined to support in terms of being much tougher against Assad, I mean, no-fly zone, bombing Assad's military assets, and all that. What if she does that? I mean, I think some people in the Senate and the House would tend to support that. Maybe they'd say she's not doing enough, but, you know, they would be inclined to be supportive. A large number of Republicans would obviously, you know, I think would turn against it, you know, no trust in Hillary Clinton, and why are we getting involved in another Middle East war? That's after all Trump's position, basically. So you could imagine a big split that's provoked not by all of us writing manifestos and having, you know, debates, but by an actual event or choice in the real world that then divides the Republican Party and conservatives. You could imagine a budget deal. I mean, I guess the debt ceiling comes, you know, we hit the debt ceiling in March. They can extend it till May or June, I gather. But there will be a moment where Republicans in the House and the Senate will have to vote on something, debt ceiling extension, and probably they'll need some Republican votes. And they might be wrapped into a budget deal, a tax deal. You can imagine a million things, right? Obamacare fixes or reforms or non-reforms. And you can imagine huge fights among Republicans and even among some conservatives over some of these things. So one thing I do think is, and I only came to this in the last week or two, that people will think we get through the election, it's November 9th, kind of back to business as usual, calms down, we get to kind of consider the future. It's not going to really be that way. It's going to be slightly chaotic and strife-torn and, you know, frantic and crazy for a few months. And that's not necessarily bad in a way. Maybe you work out some of these issues, but I think it's going to be a pretty wild, you know, first 6 months for Republicans and conservatives if Hillary Clinton's the president.
Before we completely abandon the notion of Trump winning the nomination, or not the the election, based on your observations and your assessment, would he ever, could he ever deliver on his sales pitch to the American people, you know, build the wall, et cetera, whatever that sales pitch happens to be on a given day, because it does tend to change. Do you think that he would ever have been able to actually negotiate Washington and get anything accomplished?
I mean, I'm pretty anti-Trump, but I don't totally rule it out if he were to win. I mean, there is a sane version of aspects of Trumpism. We published Erwin Selzer, a very distinguished economist, in the Weekly Standard, saying, you know what, there are better forms of the trade deal than the TPP. Parts of it could be jettisoned. There are obviously things that could be done on immigration that conservatives have long argued for that stop short of some of Trump's rhetoric. So, I mean, could you imagine a kind of a sane version of Trumpism on some of those issues? I think so. And, you know, he is a guy who's kind of success-oriented, not very ideological. Could you imagine a tax deal? I don't know, though, how much China has he broken on the way, and how much would people even be willing to negotiate with him?
Mm-hmm.
That's, I think, an interesting question. What would his administration actually look like? I mean, this is pretty... it's a very unusual situation. It's very hard to tell.
Right. And the danger, of course, is assuming that if he was to win, that he would have a Republican Senate. You know, it's a possibility that if he were to win, he could lose the Senate. I mean, he's got his surrogates actively going out there telling people to vote for Trump, but don't vote down ballot. And if he was faced with a Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, it would be a mess, I think. So I think
that's true. I think he'd probably win the Senate if he won. Just
right.
Mix with the voting, but I very much agree with you. I mean, everyone, Paul Ryan, I had this conversation with him 3 or 4 months ago. I know him some, and he was beginning the whole process, very painful process for him, of negotiating with Trump, trying to get Trump to sign on to the entitlement reform agenda that Ryan cares so much about and has done so much to advance. And remember, there were those meetings on the Hill, and people said, well, Trump said he's on board that agenda. He doesn't get to get in the details. He's going to let Ryan run everything, and he'll sign the legislation. And that was when Trump was actually close in the polls, and people thought Republicans might win everything. I remember saying to someone, he can say that, but he's shown no stomach for entitlement reform or for taking the abuse you take when you try to change Medicare or fix Medicare and Social Security. And, you know, he'll be on board that agenda until his pollster comes in, and or there's a poll taken and someone shows it to him in the White House that shows that Americans don't want to go to a premium support system for Medicare. And then they'll say, I don't really need to do that. Come on, we don't need to do that. He could end up cutting deals with Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi more easily than with Mitch McConnell and Paul Ryan on a lot of issues. I think that's what you were implying.
Right.
And I don't think that would be, you could imagine a Trump presidency that he and the Democrats are working out all kinds of obstacles to trade deals and all kinds of spending infrastructure programs and so forth.
I think because, you know, Trump, above all else, wants to be liked. And he enjoys being praised more than anything else. I think you're right. I think if let's just say that he had a Republican majority and suddenly they were talking about reforming Medicare, and of course the usual blather would start about, you know, they're going to kill old people and all the other kinds of things, and the polls would show, like you said, that it's not a popular move, and that, you know, he would suddenly say, well, we need to think of something different. So, yeah, I can definitely imagine that. Taking a step back before we kind of go back into the other side of this and the more likely scenario of him losing, you were on, just wanted to talk about, you were on Morning Joe last week, and there was a moment there where you kind of, you got very animated. I've seen you kind of get animated, but you got really upset at Joe and Mika for kind of snickering about what was going on. You know, you were taking it a little bit more seriously, and, you know, you kind of expressed some frustration about their treatment of Donald Trump in 2015 and early 2016. I think there's a lot of people who are kind of frustrated like that because, you know, Trump was good for ratings. And so these news shows, I mean, I can't recall, and Bill, maybe you can correct me, I can't recall, and I've been in, you know, watching presidential elections since, you know, 1992, ever being a time that a presidential candidate was allowed to call into a Sunday news show like Meet the Press or Face the Nation, like to do it by phone. Usually it was like, oh no, if he's going to be there, you're going to be there in studio or remote or something, but we're not going to allow you to call on the phone. And Trump was able to do that a number of times before NBC finally said, okay, that's it. We're no longer going to allow him to call in. He called into Morning Joe. He called into Fox and Friends. And so thinking back on that, what impact do you think the media had with his candidacy? Because while it's been negative, obviously, for the last several, for the last couple of months, it may not have been positive in 2015, early 2016, but certainly he was given a platform to speak a lot more than other candidates were. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, no, I think they were enablers of him, and they were happy to do it, partly for ratings and partly because they suspected he wouldn't be a good general election nominee, and most of them are kind of liberal, and now they've turned on him, as many of us predicted. I think this is a pretty common theme among conservative critics of Trump, that he's getting treated with kid gloves to some degree now, but he won't be after he's nominated, and he hasn't been, and it looks like it's working out as predicted. I guess the thing I reacted against with Mika and Joe was they were sort of blaming Trump on the Republicans, which obviously to some degree is true. He's the Republican presidential nominee. But I was just saying, and I wasn't really making a big issue of this, it was really in passing, that look, he is the nominee. He's kind of a fluke nominee. He got a minority of the vote in the primaries. He's a legitimate nominee, don't get me wrong. But, I think Mika very much wanted me to sort of be all apologetic on behalf of the Republican Party and conservatives for having produced this guy. And a lot of Republicans and conservatives have opposed this guy. And we went back and forth once or twice on that. And I just said, I don't want to totally disavow responsibility. I mean, he is, as I say, is the Republican nominee. And one reason I've been so unhappy about him being that nominee is that he will do some damage to the Republican Party and to conservatism. Anyway, but that went back and forth a little bit. And then I said, it's not like the Republican Party is the only one who enabled Trump. As you just said, I tried to say, the media enabled him. You guys were very nice to him in 2015-16. Ooh, that I think that hit a bit of a tender spot there.
that definitely touched.
They didn't like that.
No, in fact, and I'm gonna, I kind of know Joe, and he was actually on a different version of this show one time. We had a great time talking about movies and things of that nature. But he had mentioned, he said, last December I said something about, does this remind you of Nazi Germany? And he didn't say that to Donald Trump. Donald Trump wasn't on the show when he said that. He was reacting to a poll of Donald Trump's supporters in New Hampshire who were split 50-50 on the question of whether or not mosques should be shut down. That's what he was referring to. He made the same reference, by the way, to Ben Sasse back in March when Senator Sasse had kind of said, hey, the media, you guys especially, and others have been easy on Trump so far. He said pretty much what you did. And again, it was the same kind of, what are you talking about? How could, we've been tough on him. And one of your contributing editors, Mr. John Podhartz, was on Morning Joe one time and was basically explaining how disappointed he was in this candidate and Trump. And Mika actually said that he had Trump derangement syndrome.
So, I didn't know that. I forgot that. I should ask John about that.
Yeah. So that's, yeah. So I just for the record here, I think that you were absolutely right. And so your frustration was born out of, I think like you said, he was good for ratings. And suddenly when he was the nominee, now they were going to turn on him. Now it really didn't matter anymore because you're in the thick of the electoral, of the general campaign. So I don't think it matters that much anymore. But just wanted to kind of give you a chance to expand on that a little bit. And so I appreciate that. But let's take it to the next step here. And let's talk about what is the more likely outcome, is that Trump loses. And so let me ask you first, do you think, and obviously we're just kind of throwing darts at a wall here, do you think, if he loses, what's your view on the Republicans retaining control of the Senate? Do you think that's still going to happen, or do you think they're going to lose it?
We're now speaking, about 12, 13 days before the election. I mean, I've been pessimistic about the Senate for about a week or two, really ever since the audio tape, the videotape, the Billy Bush tape.
Right.
Just to say, the elections I've been through, sometimes you get a little bit of a wave and then it stops and you just got a stable situation. You lose by 6-7 points. But often these waves do kind of continue and go down ballot and things just topple at the end. And famously, Senate races do tend to all fall in one direction or another. It doesn't mean they have to. There's no law of nature. You could imagine Republicans winning 4 close seats with 51% of the vote and losing 4 close seats with 49% of the vote and splitting the kind of, 7-8 seats that are in play, presumably. and maybe holding the Senate at 51-49, something like that. But usually these things topple a little bit more one way or the other, and I guess I'd have to bet on them toppling against Republicans, because my gut instinct is that Hillary will outperform the polls a little bit, or more precisely, Trump will underperform a little. He has no ground game. I'm a little bit of a skeptic on ground games. I think it's overrated usually. You know, it's the kind of thing people who haven't been involved in campaigns a lot like to talk about, because it sounds very sophisticated. But the truth is, you know, a presidential election where everyone knows the two candidates, 98% of the voters know what they're doing and they want to vote, they vote, and they don't need you, you know, some automated phone call or live phone call, you know, coming to their home 10 times for the week before the election to remind them to vote. Having said that, when one side has a ground game and the other one doesn't, which sort of is the case this year, it seems. I mean, I know you guys live in swing states too, I think, but I live in Northern Virginia. It just, there's so much more activity for the Democrats and so much more targeting. I think it's probably worth a point or two. So if we go in on election day with Hillary up 7, I kind of think maybe it's a 9-point victory. And if it's a 9-point victory, it gets hard to hold Senate seats and right. all kinds of places. And so I'm sort of, if I had to bet right now, I'd bet on the Democrats winning the Senate. And I think the House is more at risk than people think. I think the Republicans should have pivoted earlier to making the checks and balances argument, that don't give a blank check to the Democrats. You don't want Hillary Clinton and Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi unimpeded, you know, ruining the economy and raising your taxes and expanding Obamacare. You want at least one body to be in the control of the Republicans to at least check them. It's kind of a complicated argument to make. You know, you should vote for your particular House candidate because of this macro consideration, but it's not something that has never been done before. Obviously, the Republicans did it pretty well in 1996, and I think that would work in some swing districts. You're not asking people to endorse Trump. You're not asking people to sign on to the big Republican agenda, and sometimes they're not really on board parts of that agenda. I'll give you an example. I live in Northern Virginia, in Fairfax County, where Barbara Comstock is our congresswoman. She's a pretty conservative Republican, won a good race to get elected there to succeed Frank Wolf. And I think she'll win this time. The Washington Post actually endorsed her Sunday. They had not endorsed her in 2014. And they said she's too conservative for us and we have some issues with her. But, you know, since Hillary Clinton is likely to be president, it probably makes sense to have some Republicans who are serious and responsible. And so we're going to give her the nod over her Democratic challenger. Not that will affect a huge number of votes, but some 2-4% you could imagine of independent, sort of, you know, leaning Republican types, a few leaning Democratic types could say, yeah, that kind of makes sense. And I didn't vote for Barbara necessarily last time, but, you know, in this circumstance, I think it should be a good person to have in the House. I think Republicans should talk more about Nancy Pelosi, honestly, and the threat of a Hillary Clinton, Nancy Pelosi co-presidency, if you almost want to put it that way, to try to save the House.
Bill, you mentioned, responsible Republicans, leaders. We've been hitting on that subject a little bit, and looking towards the future, let's assume that Trump loses bigly. He carries down a few people with him. Maybe the Senate is lost to us. Who do you see out there right now who you think could become a good leader in the GOP, a leader who can rally people to them and potentially navigate the minefields of this burgeoning populist sentiment and all this other stuff? Who do you see out there who is capable of doing that kind of thing, if anyone?
I mean, I'll punt a little and say that these things are notoriously hard to predict, and I'm not sure in this time of October, let's say 1988, the first national campaign I was really involved in, or first campaign really, I was running a Senate race, but I was therefore sort of involved in the national campaign, that, you know, if you'd said Dukakis is going to lose, what Democrat is going to be able to take back the White House in 92, would people have said Bill Clinton, the guy who gave a kind of semi-disastrous speech at the convention that year? Mm-hmm. You know, same with even when Dole was losing in October of 96, would people have said George W. Bush? Well, a few more would have. People were talking about him, but he at that point was a 2-year governor of Texas who his father had left the White House in tough circumstances electorally, you know, with 38% of the vote. So, I think it's very hard to tell. It's going to be a very fluid couple of years now on the Republican side. I guess my gut instinct, and I'm curious to know whether you guys think this is right, is I think it's unlikely that the Republican nominee in 2020 will be someone who ran in 2016. Right. There's not much history of parties nominating candidates the next time who lost to a losing candidate. They nominate someone who's lost to a winning candidate. Hillary Clinton lost to Obama, you know, McCain lost to Bush, and so forth. But the only time that I can think of recently that's happened with a losing candidate is actually Romney in 2012, who had lost to McCain, who lost to Obama. Romney barely, in fact, won the nomination in 2012 against an amazingly weak field, which I so I think it kind of more confirms my side of things. And I just think psychologically, as Republicans look back to 2016, whoever they were for, they could be for mm-hmm. Rubio, they could be for, could have been for Cruz, Kasich, whatever. They're just going to think, ugh, that whole, you know, it was such a disaster. Let's just move on. So I guess my instinct is to look at a whole new crop of people, most of whom have never run before, and therefore, almost by definition, it's extremely hard to know, you know, who will find the issue that will galvanize them to the front of the field in 2017 or 18. I very much like Senator Tom Cotton from Arkansas. I like Senator Ben Sasse in Nebraska. They're two of the brightest young Republican senators. I think if someone like Pat Toomey survives in Pennsylvania, A, he's a very impressive guy, and B, just surviving in this year in Pennsylvania would be very impressive. Kelly Ayotte in New Hampshire, similarly, if she survives. And then there are these governors who mostly are not on the ballot this year. They're not going anywhere. You're going to have a bunch of Republican two-term governors finishing up, in most cases, two-term limits, I suppose, in 2018, whether it's Nikki Haley in South Carolina, Susana Martinez in New Mexico, Kasich, who did run before, so in Ohio, so that's a different case. I don't know, Charlie Baker in Massachusetts, I guess he'd be a one-term governor. Some of them are quite popular in their states. And so I guess I think it'll be a lot of fresh faces, and maybe that's a good thing.
What about in the meantime, though? Like, if there's one thing that the Republican Party, I think, lacks at this point, is kind of like a national leader. Somebody that, you know, like Republicans kind of look to, whether you're conservative, whether you're moderate, that says, you know, this is the guy who we're going to, like, take direction from in some way. You know, whether it's just from a, you know, kind of a, you know, the bully pulpit mantle or something like that. A lot of people, you know, say Paul Ryan, but Paul Ryan's kind of a reluctant Speaker of the House. He's a guy who didn't even really want the job. Mitch McConnell is, you know, he's a process guy. I mean, let's face it, he's a guy that's, you know, comfortable in the Senate, knows all the rules, knows how it all works, but he's not your out front leadership type of person. Is there anybody in the party that you think? My view on this is Ben Sasse is probably the best spokesperson for conservatism that the Republican Party has right now. But is there anybody that you know of that could kind of carry that mantle until they get to a point where they're starting to look at candidates for the 2018? I don't even want to look at the 2020 election right now. I just kind of talk about what happens in the short term after.
I mean, I'm very pro Ben Sasse too. I mean, I guess the question is, if he starts doing stuff, people will say, well, it's preparatory to 2020. I think that wouldn't be his attitude, and I think it would be important that he say, look, I'm just trying to help revive conservatism here for the next 2 years. And I guess Cotton would say the same thing, and others. I mean, I think you're totally right about McConnell. The Senate leadership in particular is they're actually, you know, nice enough guys and competent senators, but neither McConnell nor Cornyn nor Thune, really any of them, I think, are national leaders of the kind you're talking about. The senators who are national leaders are more divisive within the party, whether it's McCain or Cruz or others. I mean, I like Sasse, Cotton, Mike Lee. I would say you're not going to have three more intelligent and principled, actually, senators. They don't all agree with each other on everything, but pretty conservative. Also, intelligent senators who are, what, 39 and 40 and 45 or something like that. I mean, that's a pretty impressive trio, just starting with them. And there are others who are good, too, like Cory Gardner and Joni Ernst and Dan Sullivan. So it'll be interesting to see, you know, which step forward. I mean, this is not something where you and I and others dub someone. There's a little bit of that, but mostly it's, you know, who steps forward. And you don't step forward. I mean, I used to, you know, I'm ex-academic. I like it when they give some big speech about conservatism and quote the Federalist and Tocqueville and, you know, different thinkers, Bill Buckley and stuff. But the way it really happens is usually there's a fight. There's a fight on some issue. And it's Obamacare or it's foreign policy or it's whatever, the budget. And someone says it steps up with a position, maybe it's controversial. Usually it is a controversial position. Sometimes it's a position that splits Republicans and makes a case for or against something. And suddenly that's like, you know, that's the person who's, whoa, he's making my argument on Obamacare or on the federal debt or on foreign policy. Paul Ryan, I think he's a very interesting question because he's very talented. He was he's been a congressman for almost 20 years, the vice presidential nominee in 2012, the Speaker of the House in 2016. 2016. If, and let's say they hold the House, And if you came down from Mars and sort of gave someone that, and he's 45 years old and very intelligent and well-spoken. If you came down from Mars and gave the three of us that resume, we would say, well, I guess he's the leader, right? The Speaker of the House is literally the highest ranking person in the government, apart from the president and the vice president. He's been in office 20 years since he was very young. He's a former VP nominee who conducted himself well. What's to even talk about? You know, he outranks everyone else. But he is a little reticent. He's had a rough campaign this year. I think he could step forward. That would be a real interesting question. Is that how he sees his job, or does he see his job as kind of brokering divisions in the House and stuff? Or will he say, you know, Hillary Clinton, welcome to the presidency, Madam President, and here is the Republican budget of 2017, which has these principles in it and these policies. Well, of course, we understand we're willing to talk and negotiate, but this is where we're starting, and I've got all the Republicans on board for this. I mean, and here are the, you know, here's why it's interesting and dramatic, even. It represents real change. I mean, that would be one attitude. The other attitude was, gee, we don't have the presidency. Maybe we don't even have the Senate. Let's see what we can do around the edges, and I don't have my guys or sort of differ among themselves, and so I'm not going to even be able to produce a budget. You know, you can imagine a very, and that wouldn't be necessarily foolish, so you can imagine a prudent, cautious strategy from Paul Ryan, or a bold strategy when he was a not speaker, when he was barely, I guess, just budget committee chairman. He was bold. You know, the contract, not the contract with America, my mind's going, what was it, the path to whatever it was, path to prosperity or something,
right.
I don't remember anywhere. You know, the entitlement reform document he put out, and originally it had only 8 people on board, and then eventually he gets the whole House Republican conference to sign on. And that's a very impressive achievement by a member who was not the most important member in the House. In a funny way, once since he became vice presidential nominee and then speaker, maybe understandably, he's become more cautious, consensus-oriented. I think, you know, which Paul Ryan do we get? Do we get the spearheading champion of entitlement reform, or do we get the, I need to get all my members together on the same page, and therefore I'm not going to kind of get too far out front? You know, which Paul Ryan do we get in 2017?
Interesting, interesting. You know, the thing I think about with a lot of these leaders is they're relatively young. Most are in their early to mid 40s, so they have a long time to, I guess, disappoint us, or on the flip side, maybe actually work something out and actually figure this out and emerge as leaders. And their public careers may, you know, 2 decades from now, we may be talking about, you know, President Ben Sasse or President Paul Ryan or something like that. There's still a lot of time left for them in their public careers.
Example of Obama, Clinton, W in a way, all cut the other way, which is, you know, there's a moment where you should go for it. Often that moment is when you've been a governor for 6 years or a senator for 4 years, or Clinton was a little longer, but still pretty young, 43, I think. And you just, you know, you can overthink these things and end up having been a guy who thought about running 4 times, and then you run late in your career and you don't quite make it, you know.
That's true. That's true. One of the things I did want to ask you about is, you know, it's been a really bitter election season within the GOP, and a lot of people out there have lost friendships or they have, you know, sworn, you know, eternal vengeance upon this or that candidate. You know, there's the Never Trump faction. There's, you know, so I read an article by Noah Rothman in Commentary. It was at the beginning of the month, and it was called Reconciliation and Renewal After Trump. And he made the case that we can't apply, you know, this sort of blanket condemnation to Trump supporters and people who worked with Trump or you know, that sort of thing, that we should really have an eye towards reconciliation. And at first, I'll say that I sort of didn't really like where he was going with it, because I kind of wanted, you know, blood and vengeance and that sort of thing, as one does. But upon reflection, I've kind of come around to his thoughts on that. And I was wondering where you see the possibility for reconciliation, and what parts of the Republican base or this year's electorate cannot be reconciled to one another.
look, it's a big question. I sort of had the same, I think, progression as you. I mean, obviously, if Trump gets 50 million, 60 million votes, you know, by definition, one can't, quote, purge or expel Trump supporters. There won't be anyone
right
left on the conservative side. A heck of a lot of those votes are loyal Republicans voting for Trump as the lesser of two evils because of the court or whatever, and they're not sort of Trumpites. Some millions are. Some millions of those who really are enthusiastic for Trump are, in my view, misled, and it's unfortunate, but they're decent people, obviously. Some percentage of them are deplorable, to use Hillary Clinton's unfortunate, perhaps, choice of a term, and mm-hmm. I don't even want to say they're deplorable. That's not quite right. I don't know them. You shouldn't judge people like that. The positions they're willing to espouse and defend, I think, are genuinely deplorable. I mean, really kind of intolerant, bigoted, or very foolish in terms of actual policy. And I'm sort of for being nice to people, but maybe tougher on the issues. I think there's a limit to how much you can do on some of these. What does it mean? I mean, everyone keeps saying, with some justice, you know, the elites are out of touch with the base and the public and the working class voters, and you have to sort of, you have to really get back in touch with them. Well, of course, and who's for being out of touch? Everyone's for being in touch. But what is that on trade? What does that mean? I mean, either there's going to be a trade policy of this character or of that character, right? This is an actual policy choice people have mm-hmm. to make. And either you basically think that free trade has been pretty good for America, very good for the world, lifted hundreds of millions of people out of poverty, been part of a general American-led world order, which, all things being equal, has been pretty good for most people, pretty good for the cause of freedom, pretty good for us. And, of course, there are tweaks and there are issues and there are genuine debates about particular treaties and particular provisions. But basically, we should not be going around denouncing people who've negotiated trade treaties and who believed in trade as, you know, globalists who hate America or tools of Wall Street or various other things. I mean, either you, now, if you think the free trade regime has been really genuinely bad for the country, that's a different view. But there's not that, I mean, some of these things, it's just, you have to choose a policy. So it doesn't mean you can, that anyone who disagrees with me is a bad person or that there's nothing to be said on his side. But I think on some of these policies, I'd make a choice. You know, I'm not really interested in having a party that's less condemning of dictators like Putin, you know?
I mean, right.
You know, I don't see much point in compromising on that. Immigration is a very complicated policy issue. I was against the Gang of Eight bill personally, so I'm totally, you know, I think there's many gradations of numbers of legal immigration, what to do about the illegal immigrants who are here. You know, there's many views on that, probably as there are, you know, senators in the Senate, and it's a complicated policy issue. And there's no need to demonize people who have more hawkish or dovish views on it. Again, it's lost some of it, though, as a matter of decency and respect for people, and we shouldn't be bigoted or indecent in the way we talk about other people. Trade is one where I guess I do feel, you know, fairly strongly in the sense that we've published pieces critical of aspects of TPP and stuff, but NAFTA, I mean, really, it would be bad for the Republican Party if, as part of let's be nice to Trump and Trump supporters, the party decides that the NAFTA agreement was a mistake, that we have no interest in, you know, having pretty free trade with our neighbors, that we have no interest in actually helping Mexico become a more prosperous nation, and that we're just, you know, so upset by the genuine issues and trouble and problems and job losses that come in some sectors, that we're sort of gonna reverse course. I think that would just be a mistake for the country and for the world. And so I guess I'm sort of in between, like you are, I guess, on this mm-hmm. kind of, you know, purge versus accommodate. And you look a lot, and also a lot of this is, takes two to tango, right? It takes two to reconcile. I mean,
sure.
You know, and I think there have been people who have made the case for Trump in a totally respectable way. I will have no problem with the day after the election. Right now, it's tense enough, I'm sure you guys find this too, that I don't actually go out and have drinks with someone who's sort of on the other side of it. I just, who needs it for the next 10 days, right? But Victor Davis Hanson and I, or David Galernter and I, will be able to have dinner, I'm pretty confident, in November, December, and have a very mm-hmm. pleasant conversation. Laura Ingraham, Sean Hannity, I don't know. I mean, really, do they just get a pass for denouncing? You know, really in a stupid way, in a vituperative
yes.
way.
Yes.
Everyone who disagrees with them? I mean, that's really, you know, that is just stupid, honestly. And I think they've done a fair amount of damage to themselves and a fair amount of damage to the conservative cause. And I don't see any great reason to reach out to them. I'm not going to go around insulting them. But I mean, I just think maybe they can just kind of, you know, cool off for a few months.
Yeah, well, I think that's probably.
No, I don't think they will. I don't think they'll take this advice.
Oh, no, not at all.
So, Bill, do you see a sort of a formal process for the GOP to sort of decide what it believes? Everybody kind of get on the same page, or is this going to work itself out in elections across the country and in the pages of newspapers and periodicals and on websites and just in the sort of general interactions between people who, you know, like you said, go to dinner with each other after all this unpleasantness is over?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that's how it works in a big democracy where no one is in charge of, like, hey, I mean, Reince Priebus can say he wants to do X, or I'm sure everyone's going to convene working groups and all that. But yeah, it's much more informal. I do think Congress is important, especially if Republicans control one house or both. Even if they don't, there's just a lot of, you know, if you think, okay, there's a Republican Party, there will be, let's just say, 48 Republican senators. That's, you know, there are 48 people who've been elected, you know, statewide. How they come down on a bunch of issues kind of matters. How the 215 or 230 House Republicans come down matters. How the Republican governors govern matters. And how Republican candidates campaign matters. I'm sort of a big believer that in a democracy, especially a big decentralized, federalized one like ours, which is a good thing, I think, the actual votes of voters and positions of candidates and of elected officials, you know, end up mattering quite a lot. And that's going to be something that's will also be a reaction to events. Is there a recession? I mean, let's say there's a recession, entirely possible, obviously, the next year or two. There hasn't been, we're sort of due for one, unfortunately. What will the Republican response be? Will it be kind of a, you know what, you can't afford to run $20 trillion of debt, pile up $20 trillion of debt and run a zero interest rate regime, and eventually this was going to come crumbling down, and now we got to get serious about curtailing big government? Or is it going to be, hey, yeah, we're on board for a big stimulus. We'd like it to be a little more targeted to our friends than to the Democrats' friends, you know, and let's make a deal. And those are both genuine strands within the Republican Party. And I would have trouble predicting right now which becomes dominant, or maybe they fight each other and neither dominates until 2020. It is, you hate to look ahead already 4 years to a presidential election, but, you know, I was in grad school, I guess, in 76 to 80. And you couldn't have said at this time that the Reaganites were going to defeat the Fordites in 1980. Or the moderates, let's say establishment, you couldn't even be sure in 77 or 78. And in fact, these issues were litigated back and forth, Panama Canal, supply side tax cuts, pro-life or pro-choice. And they kind of went back and forth. And it wasn't like everyone decided all at once, okay, now we're on this page. Gradually, the party assembled on more on one page than on another. And really, above all, because of the presidential selection process and the presidential nominee.
Well, I think, too, that... And Bill, I think you'll agree with this. I wrote a piece in National Review about this where, you know, some Republicans have abandoned the idea of like the incremental win. You know, take what you can. If you don't have a supermajority in both chambers of Congress, you're not going to be overturning legislation. So if you go to the negotiating table and there's something you can get, then you go ahead and get that. I think we're still going to be faced with this group of people, both I think in Congress and their supporters, who are any kind of compromise is considered giving Obama, or giving, in this case, it might be President Clinton, everything she wanted, you know, because they don't get something defunded, like Planned Parenthood didn't get defunded. So it's like, oh, they hold this sham vote where President Obama vetoed it and then they funded it anyway. Well, there's really not much that they could do. I mean, you know, it's like, were you going to shut down the government again over funding for Planned Parenthood? I think it's another thing where it's a situation where you say, okay, we've got to move forward, and we need a Republican in the White House to be able to do that. And, you know, so going back to what you were saying about people who, you know, I'm going to be a little bit more mean about it. I think people like Sean Hannity and Laura Ingraham and all of these people who align themselves with Trump to the point where they were going after others. There was somebody, one of Trump's surrogates on CNN, saying Pat Toomey deserves to lose because he's been too liberal. I don't think, you know, once this election is over, the next day, they shouldn't be like, oh, hey, okay, we're back. What are we going to do? It should be like, no. You guys sit back now and you wait until we kind of fix things and then move forward. And then we'll decide whether or not we'll let you back in. For now, though, you can go ride on the Trump train that's kind of sitting back there, crashed over in the station. So that's just my view. But
I agree. I mean, that's a good example. I love Pat. Yeah, Pat Toomey is a really strong conservative. And given that he's from Pennsylvania, not a Republican state, it's pretty amazing that he got elected in the first place. And
right.
great, if, in my view, if he gets reelected. So I agree with that. Look, there are going to be judgment calls, and we've had differences at the Weekly Standard in the 20 years we've been going about different budget deals and different other policies about where to, you know, whether this deal was a good deal or a bad deal. Obviously, that's a policy question and a judgment question. Big difference between saying, you know what, I think they could have gotten a better deal here. I wish they hadn't done it this way. And in fact, I'm going to vote against this because I think it's the wrong way to do it. I'm willing to shut down the government, let's just say, for, you know, a while on this or that. Picking to say all that, or to denounce the people making the deal as cowards and sellouts and unprincipled and pathetic establishment tools and all. And that is a step. If you're going to do that, you really need to have the evidence that that's the true motivation and that that's a fair statement, because otherwise you are poisoning the well. And I think it got too easy in, you know, the last few years of talk radio and in the last few years of political discourse generally. People were rewarded too much for that kind of rhetoric, or thought they were going to be rewarded.
Yeah, exactly.
And that, I think it's important to sort of say almost ahead of time, you know, we can have plenty of differences within the conservative movement and the Republican Party. But again, it's one thing to have a reasonable difference. It's another thing to pretend that. And I do think there that Trump is personally bears responsibility for this. He can't disagree with you without insulting you or without trying to demean you and of course, call into question your motives or your intelligence. And the Trumpites have followed suit. Some of them were ahead of Trump in this, obviously. But others, I'd say, to my surprise, have sort of gone down that path. Jonathan Last wrote a piece for us months and months ago, Trumpism Corrupts. And I really do think that people like Newt Gingrich and Rudy Giuliani are saying things on television today that I just can't even imagine them saying a year ago. Rudy Giuliani was a mayor of New York for 2 terms. He made all kinds of compromises with liberals and Democrats. And Newt Gingrich, famously, I mean, he was a tough politician, but he also cut deals with Bill Clinton and stuff. And now it's just kind of a, you know, nutty rhetoric of against other Republicans and conservatives mostly.
Yeah, right. It's felt like
they're not
invasion.
That tough on Hillary. They're not that tough on Hillary Clinton. They're not tough on any Republican who differs with them.
Yeah,
it's felt like invasion of the body snatchers for about 16 months. You know, it really has. Yeah. You wake up and all of a sudden these people are, you know, one more person has decided to jump on the Trump train. But yeah.
But let's wrap things up, though.
Let's not end on that morose note. But
yes,
that was well said, though. I agree with that.
we'll end on something a little bit more.
We will.
Yeah, a little bit more upbeat. But we weren't going to ask about this, but you kind of brought it up at the beginning. You know, the World Series. I don't know. Are you a Cubs fan or an Indians fan? I don't even know what baseball team you're.
I was a Mets fan as a kid in New York, and then kind of a Red Sox fan because I lived in Boston for college and grad school. It's funny. Then I became a mild Orioles fan in the 90s because we took our kids to Camden Yards for games, and there was a team in Washington at that time. And then, you know, kind of a very mild Nats fan, you know, when they moved here and got good. So every team I was for, Mets, Red Sox, Orioles, and Nats, made the playoffs, and they each lost as soon as they could. You know, wild card, either in the wild card game or the first round. So I'm not really rooting. We're so perverse here, as good conservatives should be, at the Weekly Standard, that Jonathan Last just literally an hour ago, before he left the office, was giving me a lecture about how we have to root for the Indians against the Cubs. So we're conservatives. We believe in tradition. The Cubs haven't won the World Series since 1908. It's a great tradition. It's a curse. It's sort of, we believe in curses and mystical, you know, clouds that hover over teams and people. And it's a great thing to keep going. And anyone could win a World Series. You know, so it happens all the time. You forget about it 3 years later. You can barely remember who won the World Series. But the Cubs have this fantastic 108-year-old thing going. And we should all be rooting for the Indians.
Tell me he's writing
that up. That is the spirit of the Weekly Standard. All of America, so far as I can tell, is rooting for the Cubs, right? Wonderful story. They haven't won it forever. The team's come from last place in the last few years with bright young general manager, some nice players, but the Weekly Standard, we're kind of, you know, rooting for the continuation of the curse.
George Will's going to be disappointed here.
Yes, that's true. Well, he deserves a lot of credit because, I mean, it's different if you've been a Cubs fan for 60 years, right, or whatever. But
yeah, and he wrote a piece, this is some years ago, about how a true conservative, Cubs fans are actually true conservatives, for the point of that they stick by the Cubs, despite the constant losing. So it'll
and Jonathan Lass would say that they can prove their conservatism by surviving another loss. You know?
All right. So the last question that we have for you, and this is the only gotcha question that we ever have for our guests. And
we never want to spring anything too crazy on our guests. We try to keep things light, but this is a big cultural issue, Bill. And so we really want to get your opinion before you answer. Just know that however you do choose to answer, it will not affect our opinion of you in any way. We will still hold you in the same high regard. But we do need, it's a binary choice. Isn't that right, Jay?
Yes, it is. It is. And we're talking when I'll let Neil kind of ask the question, but we're talking entire franchise here when we ask. It's not one particular little thing. It's the entire franchise.
Sure, sure. So the question we have, which is better, Star Trek or Star Wars?
I'm not an aficionado of either, so I'm slightly ignorant, but certainly I think Star Wars.
Oh. Well, fair point.
Is that the right or wrong answer from your point of view?
No, well, yeah, for Neil's point of view. It's a right answer from my point of view, Bill.
Well, that's so. just another in a long string of disappointments from 2016. No, I'm just kidding. No, it's fine. Jay and I just have these interminable battles where we'll never agree on things. You know, he's a Frank Sinatra guy. I'm a Dean Martin guy, you know, that sort of thing.
I mean, I saw the original Star Wars. I mean, I'm old enough to actually have seen them when they came out. Of course, I was rooting for the Empire, indeed. So that's my own particular spin on Star Wars, you know.
There you go.
Things seem to have been fine until these rebels started going. And incidentally, the rebels who claim to be the good guys, they have a queen. They're not really democratic, right?
Oh, they're not.
The Empire seemed like a meritocracy. This is a big Jonathan Lass, Sonny Bunch, you know, Matt Continetti theme, which you can take up with all of them. I'm not really well equipped to discuss it, but I'm sort of sympathetic to that.
They've drawn out the arguments very well that, you know, the standard of living across the Empire was raised. I mean, when the Empire wasn't killing people mercilessly,
trains ran on time.
All right. Well, Bill Kristol, want to thank you so much for taking time out to be on the show with us. We really appreciate it.
Hey, my pleasure. I enjoyed it.
Yeah, and your insights are welcome. And remember, everybody, check out the Weekly Standard and catch Bill when he's on Morning Joe yelling at Joe and Mika, which is always fun. And so hopefully we'll see you around. Bill, we'd love at some point, you know, maybe after the election sometime, you know, when in the new year when things get going, to have you back and kind of talk about, you know, what's
we'll
happening.
We'll talk about Tom Cruise movies.
Yeah, we'll do that.
Yeah, we'll see the movie by then, and then we can discuss.
Yeah, everybody will have seen Jack Reacher, and we can all talk about that then. So appreciate it. All right, and I'm Jay Caruso for my co-host Neil Dewing. We thank you for listening, and we will see you next time here on The Fifth Estate.